From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Search and rescue efforts are underway to help more people trapped by that massive creek fire in the Sierra National Forest in Central California, the largest of several fires burning across the state. The National Guard already managed to pull off that stunning evacuation from the Mammoth Pool Reservoir this past weekend. You may have seen the picture of campers and hikers jammed into a helicopter. Two, a Chinook and a Black Hawk, made three trips each to evacuate more than 200 people with no other way out. Joe Rosamond piloted the Chinook. He's Chief Warrant Officer 5 in the California National Guard. And Joe, you're in your hotel in Fresno getting some rest, so thanks for your time. How would you characterize this flight, given you've also flown combat?
Yeah, I've been deployed a few times throughout my 23-year career in the California Army National Guard. And this flight was definitely one of the toughest that I have ever done. Every half mile or so, we were, okay, I can see the next ridge. How's everybody feeling? All right, we're all in still? Okay. And we did that all the way until we were able to get to the lake.
Well, and tell us, explain why. What were you encountering as you were flying? I mean, people might think, yeah, they flew in, they flew out. But what was happening?
Well, if you start to compound all these different factors of it's at night, you've got fire, and it's smoky. We got all this smoke. The visibility's down to really, really low levels. Having our night vision goggles actually did make it a little bit easier because we were able to see through a little bit of that smoke. And we're having to find the outline of all the ridge lines using the light from the embers and the heat, the near infrared, you know, heat that's coming off of all those hot spots to go, okay, there's the ridge line. We can go around that.
And this is while you, I'm assuming, are getting sickened by this smoke. We're hearing about inhaling this smoke.
Yeah, it was definitely really smoky. In fact, after being in there for hours upon hours, you know, going back, even some of my crew started to feel nauseous, and they had to kind of fight through that to get that last lift done.
Yeah. Well, and so this is also, I'm sure, what you're imagining these civilians are going through.
Oh, yeah.
We understand when you got there, they were 50 feet from flames?
So, yeah, this was like the leftover embers and the burning trees and bushes and that sort of thing. And that was about 50 feet in front of the aircraft where we were. A lot of the people, they had moved all the way down to the shoreline to get as far away from that fire as they could. But still, that smoke.
Oh, yeah. So, Joe, what's your thought when you saw them? Did you think we can take them all? I mean, I know you made several trips. What was your thinking?
Well, we knew that the situation everybody was in was a real life, we call it life, limb, or eyesight deal here.
Wait, life, limb, or eyesight? They could lose one of them?
Yeah, so when the situation is such that there's a risk to life, limb, or eyesight, that's kind of the terminology we use to say, okay, we're going to start making some decisions that may not quite follow the book. And we didn't really know. That's the big thing. We didn't really know how many people there were. We just knew there was a lot. So we knew that we had to maximize the effort that we gave every single time because we didn't know how long our window of opportunity was going to remain open.
And, you know, some of these people were burned, and you saw that. You're from this area, you know. What were you thinking along those lines as you look at these people?
I didn't get to really see any of that until we were already shut down back in Fresno. I did happen to look back just to see how the loading was going, and that's when I saw some kids. Those kids were the same age as my kids, and that really hit me deep in the soul, how scared they must have been. I kind of had to get over that, and I told the guys, like, I can't look back there anymore because we got to keep going. We got to keep doing this.
Mm-hmm. You know, this has to have hit home. Do you think those people, I mean, they were already getting burned. I mean, I just don't know how they would have survived.
Yeah, I think a majority of them, they would probably have been okay if they had to wait another day. But personally, and I'm not a medical expert, but personally, I don't think there was one particular gentleman that we had on board. I don't think that he would have made it through the night if he hadn't been able to get evacuated. Just the amount of burns that he had on his body, I'm not confident that he would have made it if we hadn't been able to get it to him.
Well, thank you for that.
You're welcome. We really appreciate all the support that we're receiving.
Yeah. That's Joe Roseman, Chief Warrant Officer 5 in California's National Guard, and the pilot of the Chinook helicopter that, along with a Black Hawk, rescued more than 200 people in 3 missions each from the Creek Fire. Joe, thank you so much for your service.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Today marks 8 weeks until Election Day, and there was a debate in Iowa last night for a closely watched House race in the 1st Congressional District. Incumbent Democratic Congresswoman Abby Finkenauer is facing Republican State Representative Ashley Hinson. Just one of the races we're looking at for our Here and Now District Profile series. Radio Iowa News Director O.K. Henderson joins us now. Hi, Kay.
Hello.
And you were a moderator in that Iowa PBS debate. We'll hear some sound in just a minute. But first, just tell us about this district and how it's gone in recent elections.
This comprises about 20 counties in northeast Iowa. The communities are cities of Dubuque and Waterloo, but most significantly, Cedar Rapids, Marshalltown, and Grinnell. Those are all communities that were hit by the derecho that some of your listeners may have heard about. So that may complicate voting as people move around because their house is damaged or they completely leave the district. So that's one factor that I think worries both of these campaigns. In 2008, President Obama carried this district by 17%. In 12, he carried it by 13%. And then in 16, President Trump won the district over Clinton by 4%.
Let's talk about the candidates. First, the Republican Ashley Hinson. She spoke in yesterday's debate about police violence.
I'm 100% in favor of law enforcement, support law enforcement, and I'm 100% against police brutality. That is absolutely important, and we need to be clear on that. Ideas to defund the police in a time when we are experiencing some of these challenges throughout our communities, I think that's an absolutely radical idea. I don't support defunding the police.
What has Ashley Hinson's record been like as a state representative, and what is she focused on in this campaign?
Interestingly, both of these candidates served 2 terms in the Iowa House, so both 4 years. They've both been good fundraisers. Ashley Hinson previously worked as a journalist from a Cedar Rapids television station. She often describes herself as a recovering journalist out on the campaign trail. She's 37 years old, whereas Finkenauer is 31 years old and among the youngest elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. So that's an interesting contrast between the two of them. Hinson was turned to by her Republican colleagues in the Iowa House to sort of lead the way, particularly on transportation issues during her tenure in the Iowa House.
And what about Finkenauer? She is the incumbent, as we said. She was asked in this debate about her stance on calls to defund the police. Here she is.
I do not support defunding the police. In fact, I think right now we need to make sure there are enough funds there to have proper training. That's one of the bills also we worked on the federal level, the Justice and Policing Act.
So they sound very similar on that issue, which, by the way, is sort of representative of what we probably would see if there were a debate between President Trump and Joe Biden, both saying that they don't want to defund the police, but saying it in different ways.
Right. And Finkenauer has deep roots with Joe Biden. She actually, as a youngster, worked on Joe Biden's presidential campaign, his second campaign in Iowa. She endorsed him in advance of the Iowa caucuses. And so it was clear that, you know, she was linking her wagon, if you will, to use an Iowa phrase, to the Biden campaign early on. And I think Finkenauer and other Democrats who are running in Iowa are sort of breathing a sigh of relief that he's the nominee because that may make their path to victory easier to have him at the top of the ticket.
Mm-hmm. Are the candidates talking much about President Trump?
Well, it's interesting. Last night during the debate, Hinson was trying to tie Finkenauer to Nancy Pelosi, whereas Finkenauer, the Democrat, was trying to tie Hinson to Republicans in general. So the way they're approaching this campaign has been interesting. And other Democrats in Iowa have really not been as actively, proactively, if you will, tying Republicans to Trump. I think just sort of maybe guessing that voters know that President Trump is the head of the Republican Party.
Iowa is considered a swing state in the presidential race, but more red-leaning than, say, Wisconsin or Pennsylvania. Do you think it's in play this year in the presidential race?
Well, it certainly seems to be so, given the activity that we're seeing on behalf of the Trump campaign and the Biden campaign in Iowa. Biden has hired some staffers who have experience in past presidential campaigns in Iowa. The Trump campaign has been working, you know, to organize these boat parades. There was actually a tractor parade in western Iowa this past weekend, and folks who worked on President Trump's successful 2016 campaign here are still allied with the campaign in 2020.
Well, lots to watch in Iowa this year. Radio Iowa News Director O.K. Henderson, thank you so much as always.
Thank you.
The former FBI agent whom President Trump once accused of treason is out with a new book today that claims the president is a threat to national security. Peter Strzok is former deputy of the FBI Counterintelligence Division and was at the heart of investigations into Hillary Clinton's email server and the 2016 Trump campaign's ties to Russia. Strzok was later kicked off Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team and fired from the FBI over disparaging texts he sent about President Trump. His new book is called Compromised, Counterintelligence, and the Threat of Donald J. Trump. Peter Strzok joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Well, let's start with that title, Compromised. You write that President Trump's actions, large and small, public and secret, were so inexplicably aligned with those of Russia that the coincidence, if it was a coincidence, had become impossible to ignore. This was back before he became president. Do you think that President Trump is doing the bidding of Russia? Do you think that he is compromised?
I do. I think particularly when you look at some of his financial entanglements and other things that he has actively sought to hide, that if you're a foreign intelligence service, if you're somebody like the Russian intelligence services or the Chinese or anybody else, that same information gives you tremendous leverage over being able to influence somebody. And it goes to explaining some of the inexplicable things that Trump has done, particularly with regard to Russia, whether that's his failure to call out the Russians for placing bounties on the heads of American soldiers in Afghanistan, his failure to say anything about the attempted assassination of dissident Navalny inside of Russia, you know, the ramming of a U.S. troop transport in Syria, injuring several soldiers. Just time and time again, Trump is doing these things that are inexplicably not in America's national security interests, but do benefit Russia. And I think the compromise explains that.
When you say his financial entanglements, he has said he has no business dealings with Russia. Do you have evidence that he actually does?
Well, I think the record is clear that he does. If you look going back to his campaign, there are a number of statements that, you know, before that, one of his sons was talking about the disproportionate amount of the Trump Foundation and Trump Group's financial holdings that were held by Russia. If you look at his the actions of his personal attorney, Michael Cohen, going around seeking a deal for a Trump Tower in Moscow. At the same time Trump is doing that, or at the same time Cohen is doing that, Trump is on the campaign trail saying he has no ties to Russia. Well, that's clearly a lie. That's clearly false. At the time, Vladimir Putin clearly knew that. Trump knew that. The FBI knew that. But the American public didn't. So to keep that lie a secret gives and gave Russia leverage over him.
Many people in this country know you as the former FBI agent whose text messages with former FBI lawyer Lisa Page were released. In them, you called President Trump an idiot. You said Hillary should win 100 million to zero. People on the right especially see you as part of the so-called deep state, someone who is using their official position in the FBI to hurt Donald Trump. What do you say to those people now?
Well, I think that's an absurd accusation. Look, the fact of the matter is that I and others on the team in the fall of 2016 had enormous knowledge, which was not publicly known, that had we disclosed it, would have absolutely torpedoed Trump's candidacy. The fact of the matter is, to this day, I and others know things that would be damaging to Trump, that would hurt him right now, and yet none of us have spoken about it. So it's clear that there wasn't some attempt to undermine his candidacy or his presidency. As to the idea of personal opinions, every single FBI agent has a personal political opinion. I'm no different. But every day, my experience over 20 years was that people walk in the door and they do their job. whether that's in the FBI, whether that's in the Secret Service, whether it's in the CIA, the Department of State, or anywhere else in the government.
Well, when you say you know things that would damage the president now, what are they?
Well, I'm obviously not going to get into them. There are things that are still certainly classified. There are things that might be still under investigation. But the fact of the matter is that those things exist and they're appropriately not discussed. And so with that in mind, and of those things that are now known, the cases on all the people that we had under investigation, all the reasons why we were looking at them, all the things that are contained in the Mueller report and in the Senate Intel report, we knew many of those things throughout the fall of 2016, yet nobody said anything about them. All of them would have been immensely damaging to Trump, and yet they never came out. And that's, if anything, that's direct evidence that we were not out to get Trump, that if anything, we've been over backwards to make sure we didn't harm him or his candidacy.
Well, tell me a little bit more about that, because you do talk a lot in this book about the conflict that existed within the FBI, not just about investigating President Trump, but the other investigation, political investigation that you were involved with, which was looking into Hillary Clinton's emails. In both cases, there was a lot of debate about whether this was something that you should do and how careful you would need to be if you did do it, but also the risks of not looking into these things.
That's right. And I mean, I think it was hopefully a historic and only time we ever have investigations involving both of the candidates for the presidency. But they're very different investigations. And if you want to understand the difference in the way they were handled, the investigation which involved Secretary of State Clinton was a criminal matter that had been largely known to the public and was concluded in July. That was in a very different place in terms of being in the public dialogue, being subject to oversight and document requests and visibility with Congress, as opposed to the investigations we had on those people around the Trump campaign, which were counterintelligence in nature. They certainly had some criminal aspects. They were all classified. They were all ongoing. They weren't yet closed. And they were all very, very sensitive. So I understand people look at those two cases and say, wow, these had a really different, very disparate impact on each of the candidates. But that was appropriate, given where those cases were. And again, I'd point out, the way that those cases, the FBI either did or did not comment on them, universally across the board, tended to hurt candidate Clinton and help candidate Trump.
Right. You write that with the benefit of hindsight, I think it's likely that Comey's July 5th speech and subsequent notifications to Congress on the reopening and closing of the email investigation changed the election result. And you also write that Russia's multi-pronged attack across Democratic databases and social media to help Trump and hurt Clinton changed the result of the election.
That's right. When you look at the election with a number of swing voters, according to 538, in the states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania needed to change the Electoral College outcome could fit in one football stadium in one game, you don't need a lot to move that needle. And unfortunately, I think as I look back, as I've heard others look back, I think with the benefit of hindsight, which is an impossible standard, but when I look at that, I think I certainly would have advocated more strongly to not make that speech in July. As to the Russians, absolutely, I think they had an impact and changed the outcome of the election. What they did in such a comprehensive way in social media, in the things that they were doing to attack our voting infrastructure and casting doubt on any number of social issues, absolutely was effective enough to sway such a small number of voters that were needed to change the outcome.
Why come out with this book right now? We've had so many books about President Trump from people who've been in the government, from John Bolton. Now there's Michael Cohen's book is out today, along with your book. Do you think that you're going to change any minds? Or do you think that people have such strong opinions at this point, not just about President Trump, but about you, that they're either going to listen and believe everything you say or not listen to a word you say?
I think it'll make a difference. I mean, clearly there are people who are already set in their opinions, but there are people who are open-minded. There are people who are still trying to make up their mind what they think. And beyond just the vote, beyond simply the election that's coming up, I wanted to write a story that gave a factual, accurate recounting, not only of everything that we did through the course of the Clinton email investigation, what we did in 2016 with regard to Trump, but to give people an understanding of how the Russians work. From the perspective of somebody who, a counterintelligence expert who spent more than 20 years working this, to convey the idea and the way that a CI person would think about what is going on now and think about how to understand what Russia is and will continue to do. So I just, it's what we are facing is too critical. This is too challenging a time to stay silent. And so there was little question in my mind that I felt I needed to write the book.
Peter Strzok, you start this book talking about your career. It's a long career in counterintelligence and taking down a pair of Russian spies who lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and had been living there for a long time under false identities. And in talking about your work, it's clear that sometimes you catch people because they make little tiny mistakes. So I wonder what you think about the fact that you were taken down from your position at the FBI. You were eventually fired because of what you would even probably call a careless mistake in terms of the text messages that you were sending.
Yeah, I understand that perspective. And I deeply regret the way that some of my actions have been used to attack the things I love the most, my job, the FBI, my family, first and foremost. But at the same time, I think that when you look at the way that this was turned into a weapon, the way that the personal nature of some of these attacks are really have been done in a way that we haven't seen before in our history. And it's not just me. I mean, look at the way that anybody who has come out, you know, with weaknesses or not, from Colonel Vindman to Ambassador Yovanovitch to the unnamed whistleblower, time and time again, people who are doing nothing other than telling the truth at a lower level, doing their duty, are being attacked in a personal way by this administration in a way that we've never seen before. So, it deeply troubles me that I serve as an example of some of the just outrageous behavior by this administration. But I think we need to look at the cause of what's behind that.
That is Peter Strzok, whose book is called Compromised: Counterintelligence and the Threat of Donald J. Trump. It is out today. Peter Strzok, thank you so much for joining us.
Jeremy, thanks so much. It was good to be here.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Wednesday, September 16th from 9 to 10 a.m. sdm.mit.edu.
Everything the Federal Reserve has been doing to prop up the economy during the pandemic has made mortgages very attractive. Even as nearly 30 million Americans remain on some form of unemployment assistance, the mortgage market has been booming. According to the mortgage data firm Black Knight, lenders issued $1.1 trillion in loans between April and June. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. And Robin, this has been the best season the mortgage market has seen in decades. Is this people buying new homes or just refinancing at these low rates?
It's refinancing, Jeremy, that's truly on fire, up more than 200% in a year. And that's really a way for people who are of means, who are able to give themselves a raise of sorts in this environment, the better to handle other pandemic costs, you know, Zoom schooling or help with virtual childcare. As for the haves, many are buying second homes away from the city or upgrading to something bigger in the burbs. Home sales we saw soared by 25% in July, and that is the hottest monthly gain on record.
Which is not really surprising when you think about the fact that mortgage rates are around 3% on average, which is very low historically. But on the issue of refinancing, isn't it the case that if you want to do that, you better do it fast, because starting December 1st, there's going to be a new fee that people are going to have to pay on a lot of the refinancing that's happening?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they're still stung from the profligate lending of the subprime crisis. If you're thinking about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the kind of government backed enablers of the mortgage market. They're trying to recoup some of the billions in losses they took earlier this year by letting jobless homeowners delay their monthly payments. So there's an additional, quote, adverse market fee of 0.5% on refis due to the economic uncertainty caused by the coronavirus. And so there are some exemptions, so make sure you ask your banker for the fine print.
When you talk about the crisis back in 2008, is there a concern that because of this hot housing market in some areas, that there's a big risk of people defaulting and maybe a pileup of defaults if people have been laid off, they can't make their payments? And is there another 2008 flashing on the horizon?
The longer this continues, of course, and the more it's possible that we see speculation take over what's so far been mostly a refinancing boom, you start to worry about banks and the Federal Reserve. But they say that they are chastened and they're still passing their stress test. Jeremy, I'd also be looking at commercial real estate and the inability of companies to service mortgages made in a different pre-distanced era. I think you're starting to hear whispers about that recoursing to the banks and causing something systemic.
Meanwhile, rental demand is down. Are we starting to see lower prices show up in places like New York or San Francisco as people, as you say, flee the city in the pandemic?
Yeah, rents are down modestly in New York with the portion of no-fee listings. I mean, without a broker, they're surging, and it's definitely a soft market. While those of means, we know they've been able to telecommute from places like Westchester or Connecticut. San Francisco, meanwhile, the rents are at their lowest level in 6 years.
You know, in the past, we've heard about the V-shaped recovery where, you know, just bounces right back up like a V or a U-shaped recovery. Now we're hearing about the K-shaped recovery, meaning people who have homes and stocks, they do well, the up part of the K, and then people who rent and don't have a portfolio, not so much.
Yeah, I mean, did you have assets? Did you have capital before this catastrophe? Stocks, cash on the sidelines, equity in the house? Then you've been disproportionately able to avail yourself of the stimulus from the Fed. If you're paycheck to paycheck, if you're rent forgiveness to rent forgiveness, that hasn't much trickled down to you yet. We saw how long, Jeremy, it took after the last financial crisis.
Absolutely.
For, I think, the lower working class to avail themselves of the gains.
Robin Farzad.
We want to spend a few minutes now on ketamine, the powerful sedative normally used in hospitals, but increasingly used by EMTs called in by police to sedate suspects. In Colorado, there were 902 requests between 2018 and 19, an increase of 72%. In Minneapolis, use went from 2 police incidents in 2010 to 62 in 2017. And in a 4-day period in August of 2019, in Aurora, Colorado, 23-year-old Elijah McClain and 25-year-old Elijah McKnight were both given doses in 2 separate incidents with police. McClain went into cardiac arrest and died a few days later. McKnight was hospitalized on life support but survived. Now Aurora's city council is considering banning ketamine for law enforcement until an investigation into McClain's death is completed. Video footage of both incidents shows that neither was resisting when the ketamine was administered. McKnight actually said to a paramedic, "I'm cooperating," and a man answered, "You are, man, and we appreciate that." In Minnesota, where a study shows that 57% of people who got ketamine in 2017 for agitation ended up on life support, a former paramedic recently filed a whistleblower lawsuit claiming that police pressured him to administer ketamine when he thought suspects could be talked down instead. And the American Society of Anesthesiologists issued a statement saying they firmly oppose the use of ketamine or any other sedative hypnotic agent to chemically incapacitate someone for law enforcement purposes and not for a legitimate medical reason. Dr. Mary Dale Peterson is president of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, also an adjunct professor at Texas A&M University. Dr. Peterson, jump right in. Why your opposition?
Well, I think there needs to be a statement made that ketamine is a powerful anesthetic, especially in the dosages that we're seeing used in these situations. And with every anesthetic, there can be dangerous complications, as we have seen. And so really, when ketamine is used, it should be used for strictly medical reasons. And there are some of those medical reasons where ketamine can be useful in the pre-hospital setting.
Pre-hospital setting, you mean out in the field. What are those?
Well, anytime an EMT is called to a scene to assess somebody, so it could be in a car accident, could be even in the home, somebody having a seizure, any of those instances when you might consider using ketamine would be in fairly limited circumstances. It can be used in trauma patients that have severe fractures in small dosages to give some pain relief until they can get to the hospital. It can also facilitate putting a breathing tube in for transporting to a hospital facility. And there may be very rare circumstances where a person is in a delirious state where they are at imminent harm of hurting themselves or others, but those should be rare.
Talk about the delirious state, because there is something called excited delirium, and many police are using that as their explanation for why they felt they had to use this. in Colorado where McLean and McKnight were given the drug, police have to call for a waiver. They have to do that in order to call the EMTs to give the ketamine. And to do that, they have to diagnose the person with excited delirium. What is that?
Well, first of all, a police officer is not trained to diagnose delirium, excited delirium or otherwise. That really should be the role of the medical personnel. So there needs to be that, you know, really evaluating the person before administering any kind of drugs. There is some controversy in the medical community over the terminology of excited delirium. We certainly know that there are certain drugs that can cause delirium. I don't think the two cases that you mentioned at the beginning of the segment, that those individuals exhibited that, though.
Yeah, it seems as if this phrase is being used so much that people are saying that, you know, someone who's just upset because they suddenly find themselves, you know, on the ground being arrested by police, that is not excited delirium. That's just being upset, and that phrase is being misused. And I'm going to mention something only because I'm sure there are other people who have had ketamine in a hospital situation, as I had. I had a surgery once on a near severed thumb, very, very painful. And the last thing I remember is the anesthesiologist telling me, I've got something for you, before I went in. And I believe it was ketamine. And as soon as he administered it through an IV line, it was an actual beautiful feeling. So people who may have also had that experience in a hospital, why is not that the experience that obviously we're seeing people who are suspects have out on the street?
Ketamine is an interesting drug. It's called a dissociative anesthetic, and it works differently than some of our other anesthetic agents. And I think one of the differences is that the dosages being used is significantly higher than in some of these cases than what we would use in your situation that you experienced. And then every person is different in how they experience mm-hmm. drug. About 20% of people will have hallucinations or bad reactions when they wake up to ketamine. Sometimes, if we're giving it, we'll give some other drugs along with ketamine that really lessen that chance of bad hallucinations. Mm-hmm. But ketamine has broad effects on the respiratory system, the cardiac system. You have to understand all the pros and cons of giving ketamine and in the correct dosages and with monitoring and really having somebody there that can be available and ready to step in as somebody stops breathing or becomes hypoxic or their blood pressure rises or the heart rate goes up too fast.
Or as the EMT who was filing a lawsuit said, Joseph Baker, he pointed out it could be low blood sugar. It could be, you know, a diabetic who's hallucinating because they have low blood sugar. It could be a number of things, and administering the ketamine could cause problems. And we should say that in the case of Elijah McLean, he only weighed 143 pounds, and he was given a dose for a 200-pound man.
Yes. You know, they're pretty large doses. And I know it's difficult in the field to perhaps estimate weights, but I think that's why it's really important that as much of an evaluation can be done by people with medical training. And it's just as that paramedic said, people can have behavioral disturbances for a lot of different reasons. People, like you said, that become hypoglycemic. There are other electrolyte abnormalities that can make people act very unusual. And you really need to get to the root cause of that situation.
What would you say to police who say we're facing far more people who are mentally ill, who might be on drugs and are therefore, you know, as the saying goes, they're super strong, they're struggling. We're not sure if they're going to harm themselves or a first responder, an EMT.
Well, I sympathize with that because I think we do have really a mental health crisis in the United States. That's why we need more crisis intervention teams and more training of police officers in behavioral health. But I think that to ask an EMT to give ketamine as a chemical restraint when the person is already restrained is inappropriate.
What would you like to see happen? Because there's no national standard.
Well, I think that states that have these ketamine waiver programs should be reviewing them with their medical directors. We definitely should be looking at what the complication rates are and how we can avoid those. That's any kind of continuous quality improvement that, you know, any medical system of care should have. So I think any time it's been given in the field, those cases should be reviewed. They should be scrutinized and overseen.
Would you like to see it withdrawn entirely for strictly law enforcement purposes? Your statement seems to say that. In other words, the suspect who's on the ground and in handcuffs but is, you know, still agitated, it sounds like you're saying that just shouldn't be used for that.
That is exactly right. So there are legitimate medical reasons for giving ketamine in the field. In trauma where patients have lost a lot of blood, it may be safer to give a small dose of ketamine for pain relief than other drugs like morphine. And that may help, you know, get somebody with multiple fractures stabilized into the hospital. But it is about doing it for the right reasons, in the right dosages, with monitoring and well-trained personnel under medical direction, but not just for law enforcement purposes. That is correct.
That's Dr. Mary Dale Peterson, president of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, which released a statement opposing the use of ketamine, as you just heard, as a tool of law enforcement, as it's increasing across the country. Dr. Peterson, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Appreciate the opportunity.
Some of the biggest news stories find their way into music. If you search Spotify or Apple Music, you'll find a lot of songs right now about COVID-19. And this summer, after the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and the subsequent protests, there have also been many new songs about racial injustice. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports on two Philadelphia singers who are putting out new music for this moment in America.
Gashina Pindell is many things.
Hey, y'all, what's good? My name is Extra Cash. Cash Moolah, Cash on the Man, Cash in Hand, you know what I'm saying.
After spending a lot of time performing in clubs around Philadelphia, about a year ago, Extra Cash decided to focus on her internet presence, regularly posting videos on TikTok and Instagram. She broke herself into four different personalities and gave each a name.
Keisha is like the more stern one. She's like the big sister, kind of knows everything. Alexis is kind of, she's hood, you know, but she's got a soft heart. China, that's like really sensitive and kind of emotional. And then you have Heather, that she's like more level-headed.
Together, the four Cashes sing cover songs on a split screen with their own reworked lyrics, trading lines like they're having a conversation.
Say her name, say her name.
In her four personalities, Extra Cash covers Say My Name, a song by Beyoncé's old band Destiny's Child, but she changed the lyrics to Say Her Name, a popular protest chant remembering black women killed by police, especially Breonna Taylor from Louisville, Kentucky.
Waking up, it's the same. Killers going free, and to me it's just insane. They started this violence, wanting our compliance. See how they kill our people, then expect us to stay silent. Lock 'em up, lock 'em up.
While one of the officers has been fired for blindly firing into Taylor's apartment, none of the officers who shot her has been charged, despite ongoing protests calling for holding the police accountable. After Say Her Name exploded on TikTok, getting more than 500,000 views, Pindell got the ultimate accolade. Beyoncé herself reposted the video on her personal Facebook page. Pindell was not always writing protest songs. She came up with the idea of splitting herself into four personalities as a clever way to cover R&B songs.
The four Cashes were definitely singing about boys. And yeah, it was mainly love. It wasn't anything really about, like, society or what's going on, but it's definitely changed now because seeing the injustice, it has created a fire within me.
The four Cashes don't always agree with each other. For another song, a cover of DaBaby's Rockstar, Pindell's personalities talk about the rioting and looting earlier this summer triggered by the death of George Floyd. They have different reactions. While China is overwhelmed and depressed, Alexis is up in arms.
I know you're stressed about life, but this is the time to be strong and fight. Take all your anger, take all your rage, and use it right now to make a change.
One of the girls was happy, I think it was Alexis, was happy that there was looting happening, You know what I mean? And honestly, that was a real feeling within me. And I don't think it's good that those businesses had to suffer. But at the same time, I felt like somewhat of a release because I feel like people are angry. And at some point, it's only so much that they can take in terms of injustice and not being treated fairly.
Another Philadelphia musician, the rapper Louis V. Gutta, also had not been particularly political in his music until recently. He's known for his songs about life on the streets and anthems to making money, not for taking stances on racial justice.
I don't usually speak on this stuff, you know what I mean? Because I rap about the streets and, you know, how I came up. It had nothing to do with politics.
Black man in America.
During the protests in the wake of police killing George Floyd in May, Gutta wrote Black Man in America.
Unemployment rate sky high, but somehow we still got the hardest job. Black man in America.
That America in the title is spelled with three K's.
Yeah. My skin is black as they heart. How you grown, but you still scared of the dark. They outline us in white chalk. We gotta fight for the cause.
The video for Black Man in America is made of clips showing this history of police abuse in America from the 1950s, showing two white police officers dragging a black man down a street, right up to June, when Philadelphia police fired tear gas at protesters as they scrambled up the embankment of a highway.
You know, just trying to show how much hasn't changed. Why does my son, I just had a son, so is this going to be over with by the time my son gets to grow up? You know what I mean? Like, does he have to deal with the same stuff we're dealing with now? I just wanted to show it's a pattern, and it just keeps happening and keeps happening and keeps happening.
Before the pandemic and social unrest of 2020, Gutta had an album recorded and ready to go, but this summer was not its moment. It's called King of the North, and it's what Gutta calls normal hip-hop.
Club records, street records, just normal, like how life was before this happened. That's what I mean. Like up-tempo, upbeat records, that's good. Like when you're in a good space, when you feel like, you know, life is good. It's not good right now.
Maybe next year. For now, Gutta plans to include Black Man in America on an EP of new music recorded during the pandemic. It will be called So Help Me God. For Here and Now, I'm Peter Crimmins.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.